It's half past eight.
It's half past eight, New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Each week at this time, Lucky Strike provides four experts for you to stump. You furnish the questions and our experts try to answer them. For every question used, Lucky Strike will reward you with $10 in United States savings stamps. If the question is muffed, you get a total of a $50 United States savings bond plus the 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information, Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of similarity, we'll have to be sole judge of who shall be paid, and all questions become the property of Information, Please. And now light up a lucky strike as I present our master of ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, spontaneous and unrehearsed as usual, Information, Please tonight offers the following board of experts: Oscar Levant, John Kieran, and Franklin P. Adams. And as our guest of honor, the well-known foreign correspondent and author of People Under Hitler, Mr. Wallace R. Jewell. Now, we're going to begin with a question that comes to us from Chicago. Mrs. Sophie Wyatt thought this one up. There are four parts. Get three out of four. What word, gentlemen, means both scraps of old waste materials and a flat-bottomed boat? Mr. Adams.
Scow.
Scow. Old waste materials would not be scow.
No, but I don't know any other word for a flat-bottomed boat.
Okay. Well, that's 50% right and 50% wrong. It's the same word that means both. Does it come to you, Mr. Kieran? Well, I'll have to throw it at you, gentlemen. Junk. Junk. Means both waste materials. Have you ever heard of a Chinese junk?
Junk is not a flat-bottomed boat, I'm sorry to say. We have plenty of junks going right around New York Harbor at this time.
Rounded?
Oh, yes.
Really? Well, they're a flat-bottomed boat.
You can't sail a flat-bottomed boat.
Do you want to?
I should have said just any sort of bottom boat.
A boat
would have been better. Yes. But that wouldn't have given Mr. Adams any further hint, I don't think. How about a word that means both the collapse of a stock market and a type of linen cloth? Mr. Adams.
Correct.
Ah, there you go. That's retrieving it. Now, how about this one? This seems to mean two things that are just the opposite of each other. The same word means both to stick or adhere and to split or divide.
To paste somebody in the jaw.
Means, you don't necessarily divide them unless you have great luck.
We'll see about that in an hour.
It's a tough one to get, but the word is cleave, which, as you see, means both to stick to something and to split or divide it. That's a tough one. How about a word that means both a leaf of thin metal and a blunted sword? That would be what? Mr. Jewell.
Foil, isn't it?
Foil, yes. Very good, Mr. Jewell. We got two wrong out of four on that. That sends a $50 savings bond to Mrs. Wyatt and a set of the Britannica. And starts us off very cheerfully. Now, how about this one from Millard Taylor of Arlington, Virginia? This is a musical question. You're going to listen to four different pieces of music. And if you listen carefully, each of them should put you in mind of some kind of conveyance. How might you be traveling if you listened to what you're going to listen to now? Go ahead. Now, how would you be traveling, Mr. Levant?
It's called Louisiana Hayride. I don't know how they travel on a Louisiana Hayride.
You have never seen
on
a hay
car. On a hay car.
That's it.
What's a hay car?
You don't know what that is. Mr. Adams, will you enlighten our urban friend over there?
I would go on the yellow taxi.
That's a wagon.
Yeah, you know, he doesn't know what a wagon is either. You have to explain it to him after.
A horse-drawn wagon.
Performance. If you think he knows what a horse is, you're still mistaken, Mr. Adams. All right, let's listen to the next. Is that familiar to any of you except Mr. Levant? Mr. Levant.
It was played too turbulently, incidentally. It's, he'll forgive me for that criticism. It's Troika by Tchaikovsky.
Yes, and what is a Troika?
It's drawn by those horses you said I don't know. In the old days,
they do
by
up.
The better class Russians. It was with a sleigh instead of wheels.
It's a sort of sleigh, that's right. Now the next one. Now, how would you be traveling if, according to that music, does that do very
show me how the way to go home?
Yes.
Isn't it?
How would you be traveling?
You'd be drunk.
Yes. You might be a little
tottering.
Yes, tottering.
Attractive, probably.
Quite right. and the fourth and last.
Oh, there I go.
Well, I tell you, the rest of you are having a fine time with this question. Mr. Levant.
That sounds like the opening of Porgy.
But how would you be traveling if you were listening?
You mean to go to the show or in the show?
Well, that particular music...
That's the prelude, I think.
On a hand car.
No, goat wagon.
Yes, on a goat car. That's right. On a goat car.
I don't know what that music has to do with it, but it's all right.
That's the accompanying music as...
Oh, really?
Porgy goes out in the goat cart, I do believe.
Thank
how about this one from Gerald Weil of Toledo? Why wouldn't you see, why would you not see, any of these advertisements in pre-war German newspapers? Might still be true, but we know that you wouldn't see them in newspapers before this war began in Germany. Here's the first advertisement. Honor your loved one. Buy plants here for Memorial Day planting. Why wouldn't you see that in Germany a few years ago in the papers, Mr. Duell?
The best reason I know is that the plants were not available.
Oh, there were no plants.
That what kinds you planned on a Memorial Day.
Well, there might be another reason. Mr. Levant?
It has to do with the type of burial. They wanted to salvage something even in burial. Do they cremate there? I don't know.
Who knows?
Mr. Duell.
Mr. Adams.
I don't think they have any Memorial Day.
Well, they're not allowed to adorn graves. Apparently, the gesture is considered much too sentimental for them. Much too good for them, I should think.
Matter
how about
fact,
this, Mr. Duell?
They are allowed to decorate graves that would depend on the regulations for the local cemetery as worked out by the party official in charge. They might be allowed to.
It might be allowed.
Depend on him. Cut flowers were not allowed to be put on graves.
You got that out of your
book, too complicated.
Now, here's another advertisement. Why wouldn't you see this? Fresh bread now on sale. New baking every day. Mr. Duell.
Because it was forbidden to sell bread that had been baked within 24 hours of sale.
Why?
On the theory that it wasn't as appetizing and so people wouldn't eat as much and so bread would be saved.
I suppose there's something in that, as a matter of fact.
I found it so.
How about this? See the great Hernando make an egg vanish into thin air. Mr. Duell.
Because magicians were forbidden to use eggs or any other foodstuffs in their tricks. They were also forbidden at the same time to explain their magic, because, of course, if you start explaining sleight of hand in Nazi Germany, you never know where you're going to end.
Well, that gives us three out of three.
Book,
how about this one? From Mrs. A.J. Strom of Long Beach, California. Get three out of four if you can. What's being described in these alliterative adjectives? What is alliteration, Mr. Adams?
I'm lucky I know what adjective means.
Similarity of letters in beginning words.
Yes, right. Now, here are some examples. Grim, ungainly, ghastly, gaunt. What's being described?
Thomas Wolfe. Thomas Wolfe?
No. Mr. Kieran?
I think that's Raven.
Yes, it's from what poem?
Poe.
Yes, the whole line goes on, grim, ungainly, ghastly, gaunt, and ominous bird of yore. That's not a very familiar line from the Raven. Mr. Duell, you had your hand up. What were you going to say?
I was about to commit an error.
Never have asked you. What did you think it meant, just for fun?
I didn't understand that it came from a definite poem, and I've heard that phrase applied to one of Jacob Epstein's statues of Lincoln.
That's going rather far afield. Now, each of these is a quotation that describes a particular thing. Short and simple. We have several hands. Mr. Adams.
Annals of the Poor.
Yes. From what poem?
Elegy written in the country churchyard.
Very good.
No grandeur here.
No grandeur here with a disdainful smile. The short and simple annals of the poor. Now, here's a Latin phrase that I think will be familiar to many of us. Dulce et decorum, Mr. Kieran.
Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. From Horace.
From Horace, from the Odes and the translation, Mr. Kieran?
It is sweet and pleasant to die for one's country.
Yes, sweet and fitting, perhaps, honorable,
right.
Or worthy. So the dying for one's country is being described there. Now, what's being described in the phrase 2 and 20? 2 and 20. Mr. Kieran?
A young man.
Yes, who is it?
But now I'm 2 and 20. That's A. E. Houseman.
A. E. Houseman. What's the burden?
No, it's true.
No, it's true. It's true. What's true? Do you remember, Mr. Adams, what he said?
Shouldn't have given his heart away.
That's it. He was a little too generous with his heart. How about this one from Mrs. Douglas Bogue of Tampa, Florida? What's the significance of these phrases that are all about animals? And these phrases have been seen in the news during the last few months. Get two out of three. The first phrase is sea otters. Sea otters. It's dual.
It was a new type of flat-bottom ship designed for speedy construction and economical operation in the shipment of supplies to Europe.
Yes,
that's primarily to Britain.
That's correct. How about foxholes? Foxholes, Mr. Levant?
Isn't that what the Japanese always report in the incursion or in that peculiar kind of invasion they made in Malaya? They resort. Or Bataan, it's in Bataan.
It's in Bataan.
Yeah.
I think in connection with what, Mr. Kieran?
The force that is still in on the Bataan Peninsula that was left by General MacArthur.
Yes, they fight in sort of one-man trenches. Each man picks out a foxhole for himself. Right. How about flying tigers? What does the phrase recall to you, Mr. Kieran?
Flying tigers is the nickname of the American volunteer flying force operating along the Burma line.
Yes, fighting the Japanese. Mr. Levant.
Is that a combination of American and Britain?
I think they're American volunteer flyers, and they're giving a very good account of themselves, as we all know. How about this one from Mrs. Lewis H. Green of Manasquin, New Jersey? Get to
Manasquan.
Manasquan. Very sorry. I apologize to Manasquan and to Mrs. Lewis H. Green and to this group of inexorable experts. How about this? Name the spinners or weavers who did the following jobs. The first spinner or weaver saved a lady's life by doing a job that she couldn't manage for herself. He did it for her.
What's a spinner?
It's like a horse, Mr. Levant. Just one of those things you don't know.
A roulette spinner?
You know this stuff, cloth that we wear?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, a spinner. Mm-hmm. That's not a spinner.
Well, that's in mythology, isn't it? Greek mythology?
No, it isn't.
Well, I'm sorry.
It isn't in Greek mythology. It's in folklore.
That isn't a Flying Dutchman you're talking
about. No. Remember Rumpelstiltskin, the little dwarf who, spun straw into gold for the girl who couldn't do the job for herself in the old story of Rumpelstiltskin? Does that come back to you at all?
Not at all.
All right.
Before my time.
Well, that's one wrong. Now, what spinners fooled 11 tigers? What spinners fooled 11 tigers?
Is that a football team, the Princeton?
That's very good, Mr. Levant.
Well, any team beat Princeton in the last 20 years.
What does the phrase spinners mean in this case?
Oh, that's that play with football. A quarterback. It's a deception. Right. A handling of a ball with you. Mr. Kernel.
Yeah. It probably means Harvard this year. They use a lot of spinners.
Spinners. There was one particularly famous game.
The greatest spinner in 1941. Was on Harvard. I forget his name.
I don't mean that kind of spinner. The spinner play in Harvard helped them to defeat Princeton in a famous game during the 1937 season. They beat them 34-6.
They use it every season.
I'm sure they do.
And they get licked every year.
That's the only information I have, though. Now, can you name, in this case, it was a weaver who worked for years on a robe to be used after her father-in-law died?
A weaver?
I think it was a weaver, yes.
What did he work on, cloth?
Worked on cloth, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't give you any hint, does it?
Yeah. Levant?
Who?
Well, when Gloria Swanson returned to Hollywood, they had a big, big cloth thing on the floor so she wouldn't get her feet close to the ground. Could that have been it?
No, but it's nice to know it. Very nice to know it. No, it was the web that Penelope, in the story of the Odyssey, the web Penelope, remember, raveled each night to put off the suitors? And this web was to be a funeral robe for Odysseus' father when he should happen to die. It was just a deception, of course, that enabled her to keep the suitors away. Well, that gives us two wrong out of three and sends a $50 savings bond to Mrs. Green and a set of the Britannica. Now, Lucky Strike so far has paid out two of those bonds and two sets of the Britannicas. Now, Mr. Cross shows us how a tobacco expert might edit a certain well-known work by Mr. Funk and Mr. Wagnalls.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, for a tobacco expert, the dictionary's definition of mildness would seem incomplete. He'd want to add, cigarette mildness depends upon the kind of tobacco used. And that holds true of better taste and other fine qualities you want in a cigarette. They all depend on tobacco. For remember this, in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. That's why Lucky Strike consistently pays the price to get the finer tobacco at market after market, year after year. For example, in Ahoskie, North Carolina, at auctions of the 1939 crop, the American Tobacco Company paid 32% more for the tobacco it bought for its cigarettes and other tobacco products. Yes, 32% above the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. And that crop, properly aged, mellowed, and blended with other fine crops, is in the Luckies you buy today. Mr. Fadiman, aren't facts like these worth every smoker's attention?
Mr. Cross, the figures tell the story, and I timed you at just 59 seconds. But we'll go on with a question that comes to us from Warren T. Abbott, a commandant of the Marine Corps League in this city. A musical question again, and I think we all ought to be able to join in. What military or naval association do you have with the following pieces of music? Get 3 out of 4. Let's have the first. Mr. Dillon.
Field Artillery.
What song is it, particularly?
Over Hill, Over Dale.
Yes.
The Cajuns go rolling.
That's quite right. Very good. Well, that was very easy. Mr. Adams and Mr. Jewell are now shaking hands with each other. I don't see why either should congratulate the other. It's a very easy question. How about the next? Oh, I have 4 hands. Mr. Kieran.
Anchors Away.
That would be all. The Navy, of course. Very good. Now the next one. All hands again. Now, Mr. Adams.
Through the shores of Tripoli.
Very good, Adams. And you are singing, so to speak,
the United States Marines.
The United States Marines, right. From the shores of Montezuma and so forth. And now the fourth and last. Several hands, Mr. Levant.
Well, that's the West Point song by Rudolph Fimmel, taken from the Vagabond something.
That's right. The West Point March. That's a perfect
response. Sons of Plum and Gravy.
Do you know how it goes on? How about this? That's 4 out of 4, and this sends us on to a question from D.E. Bliss of Steubenville, Ohio. A more or less literary question. Name the character or persons, some of these are real people, some more or less fictional, who said, the first one said, well, Anna is the subject of my story. Mr. Kieran.
Non Cassius.
Cassius is right, yes. In what play?
Julius Caesar.
In Julius Caesar.
By W. Shakespeare.
That's not a
John very... W. Cassius.
How about this one? This is all, these questions are all about honor. Who is not without honor, save in his own country and in his own house? Mr. Jewell.
The prophet.
The prophet. And the quotation is from what source, Mr. Jewell?
It's the good book, isn't it?
Yes, it is the good book. It's from the book of Matthew. How about, who pledged their fortunes and their sacred honor? Mr. Kieran.
The signers of the Declaration of Independence.
Yes, and we might repeat that sentiment. We mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Who cared more for honor than for his girlfriend? Mr. Adams.
Richard Lovelace.
Richard Lovelace. Who was Richard Lovelace, Adams?
He was a man who said, I love thy not honor more.
Yes, he prefaced it by saying, I could not... Love thee, dear so much. Love thine honor more.
Colonel Richard Lovelace.
Was he, Colonel?
I thought he was a sir.
How about this one? This comes from Alex V. Boyd of La Jolla, California. Here are the first names of Indian leaders who are now in the news. What are their last names, and what does each of these personalities stand for politically in India? Pandit Jawaharlal. Pandit Jawaharlal. Mr. Jewell.
Nehru, isn't
Nehru,
it?
Nehru, he represents the Muslim group.
Well, he represents the nearest thing to an all-India national leader. That is, he's the head of the All-India National Congress Party, which does contain a representation of the Muslim group.
Mr. Cripps thinks he's important.
Mr. Cripps thinks he's important, and Mr. Cripps is right. How about Archibald Percival, Mr. Levant?
Is that Wavell?
It is Wavell. And what is Wavell?
He's commander of the armed forces in India.
In India and in Burma. Quite right. Now, how about Muhammad Ali? Muhammad Ali, Mr. Kieran?
Oh, Muhammad Ali.
Muhammad. Muhammad Ali.
Well, I take it back.
This may be an unfamiliar one, but
well,
it's very important
to say
Gandhi,
but that isn't quite as
he's the son of the prophet.
Well, I don't know what Muhammad's...
prophet must have lived a long time.
This particular Muhammad, Ali, has as his last name Jinnah, J-I-N-N-A-H, and he is the leader of the Muslim League in India. The problem, Mr. Cripps, of course, is complicated by the fact that India is split, to some extent, among the Muslims and the Hindus. How about Mohandas Karamchand?
Mr. Cripps is, he's the man who came to Jinnah.
That's very good, Mr. Adams.
Mohandas Karamchand, Mr. Curran.
Well, I think that's Gandhi.
That is Gandhi, yes. And what's his position in India today, Mr. Curran, briefly?
Well, right now I don't know. He was the head of the sit-down peaceful resistors.
Yes, Mr. Levant.
Well, he's a pacifist by temperament. I think he's an elder statesman in regards to Nehru. That's the way I would regard it.
That's a very good way of putting it. He was formerly the leader of the National Congress, and he superseded as an active leader by Nehru, but still has enormous influence, very properly, in India.
Did you notice my political tact?
Yeah, no, this is stuck out like a sore thumb.
Maybe I'm the man to send in you.
How about this one from Mac Levin of Milwaukee? This is all about tyranny. I'm going to give you some quotations about tyranny and see if you can identify them for us. What is the worst tyranny, quote, on humankind? Mr. Duell.
It's the tyranny, it's from the panther and the hind. It's the suppression of intelligence.
That's quite right, Mr. Duell. The answer is correct.
Quite a quotation.
It's a tough quotation, and I don't think most of us would know it. I certainly wouldn't have. Of all the tyrannies on humankind, the worst is that which persecutes the mind. And who wrote the lines?
Dryden, wasn't it?
Yes, Dryden.
The Hind and the Panther.
The Hind and the Panther. The lines are very pertinent today. Now, how about this? What makes tyranny tremble? Mr. Adams.
Thy mandates.
Or is it thy banners? Seems to me...
Thy banners make tyranny tremble when borne by the red, white, and blue.
That's right. From Columbia, the gem of the ocean. Who shouted, liberty, freedom, tyranny is dead?
Did they shout that?
Somebody did. Mr. Curran, I might expect you to know this, just possibly. It was the character Cinna in Julius Caesar after the murder of Caesar.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's, well, that's all right. You needn't be apologizing. Happens once in a lifetime, Mr. Curran. Shouted, liberty, freedom, tyranny is dead. How about this?
Let's see. You're shouting it now.
You got two out of three. How about this from Mrs. Mary Kearsley, Santa Monica, California? Which of these articles, gentlemen, is subject to a federal retail tax? A tube of shaving cream. Yes or no? Mr. Levant.
No.
No is right. A jar of cold cream. Any federal retail tax on that?
If we know that, it's indicting.
how about it, gentlemen?
What? Yes.
Yeah, that, is that a guess? Mr.
No.
It is.
Yes is right. And what's the reason for a jar of cold cream being
taxed? Well, it's supposed to be a luxury.
Well, it's a, yes, cosmetics in general are considered luxuries. How about a fountain pen? Any tax on that? Mr. Adams, what would you think?
I would think yes.
Well, you would be wrong. No is the right answer. What were you going to say, Mr. Levant?
I get mine for nothing.
I won't say anything, no.
No, a fountain pen is not taxed. I suppose it's considered a necessity, more or less. So how about a watch? Would that be taxed? A watch?
No.
Yes.
Yes.
Watch and jewelry. Don't you people pay any attention?
Have more watch lately.
They always charge a tax on everything, though. I don't know why.
No, that's the way it seems.
Federal tax?
No, no, there's no tax on a watch. Well, that sends a $50 savings bond to Mrs. Kearsley and set up with a banker. We only got two out of four right on that. How about this? From Ruth C. Sprague of Needham, Massachusetts. Get two out of three. Who made these remarks and when? During wartime. Here's the first. The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime. Mr. Duell.
He was then Sir Edward Grey, later Lord Grey of Falloden, who was British Prime Minister, British Foreign Minister, I beg your pardon, Foreign Secretary, in 1914.
Yes, and it was then that he made that famous statement, and perhaps it was truer than it seemed to be at the time. Here's another. Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Mr. Curran.
That was Abraham Lincoln, the second inaugural address.
Yes, in 1865.
Carved in the stone in the Lincoln Memorial on the east side.
Yes, those are very moving words, Mr. Curran, but actually there's a defect in them from the point of view of craftsman and prose. Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. As prose,
scourge doesn't pass away.
No, it isn't that. It's the fact that the line has both rhyme and rhythm. And it's a curious thing that good prose should not have any easily observable rhythm. And what do you think?
I object.
Well, tell me why.
It sounds good.
Do you like that?
I love it.
Actually, when you have rhyme and prose, it doesn't sound good to some ears. How about this one? Now, no matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. Yes, Mr. Duell.
It's the president's address asking for a declaration of war.
Yes, quite right. And how about this from Morris Goldberg of Philadelphia? The pianist is going to play the endings of three famous piano cadenzas or unaccompanied passages just before the conductor gives the signal for the orchestra to start. Identify each one, if you can. Let's have the first. Mr. Levant?
Well, I don't know it. I would like to hear the whole thing.
We had time.
No, what is it?
It's from the Mozart D major concerto.
I was going to say, Mark, whose cadenza is it?
I have no idea.
Well, I mean, I play that. You can use any cadenza you like. It's not an arbitrary thing, and Mozart's not around lately.
We've only got about 40 seconds to argue this out. How about the next one? Yes, Mr. Levant.
That's Brahms B flat.
That's perfect, Mr. Levant. Very good. And now the
you
third one.
30 seconds now. Schumann.
That's good.
A minor.
Which one? The A minor. Very good, Mr. Levant. That's not very easy going. And now Mr. Cross says he's running into quite a few people who have an ear for a mnemonic phrase.
Well, several of my friends have been greeting me recently with this phrase, smoke the smoke, tobacco experts smoke. And, ladies and gentlemen, I'm glad that's catching on, because never was more smoking wisdom condensed into fewer words. After all, in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. So you can see why the overwhelming preference of independent tobacco experts for Lucky's, their stamp of approval, is definitely worth remembering and worth acting on. For these independent experts spend their lives buying, selling, and handling tobacco. And at markets all over the South, year after year, they see us pay the price to get the milder, better-tasting leaf. For example, in Fayetteville, Tennessee, at auctions of the 1939 crop, the makers of Lucky's paid 23% more than the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. At Whiteville, North Carolina, 36% more, and so on at market after market. And that crop, properly aged, mellowed, and blended with other fine crops, is in the Lucky's you buy today. No wonder that with independent experts, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-to-1. Smokers, remember, in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts, and Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. Those are the simple facts behind our phrase, smoke the smoke, tobacco experts smoke.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. This evening, Lucky Strike has cheerfully paid out three $50 United States savings bonds and three sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Thank you, Mr. Jewell, for coming to Lucky Strike's party tonight. Now, next week, Mr. Adams and Mr. Kieran will sit in with two guests, our old friend, the famous critic and composer, Deems Taylor, and as our special guest, Madame Ivy Litvinov, author and translator in her own right, and of course known to all of us as the wife of the Soviet ambassador to the United States. Remember, for every question answered correctly, the sender gets $10 in United States savings stamps. And for every question that stumps our board, you get a total of a $50 United States savings bond, plus the complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your letters with questions and the correct answers to information, please, at 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now, a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speed Riggs, famous tobacco auctioneer from Goldsboro, North Carolina.
That chant, ladies and gentlemen, is your reminder to smoke the smoke tobacco experts smoke.